The future of relations with North and South Korea. The eyes of the world are on South Korea this week as the Olympic Games are set to kick off in Pyeongchang. The Games come at an unprecedented time for geopolitics in the region. There is an apparent thaw in relations between North and South Korea. And for the first time ever, the countries are fielding a unified sports team in women's hockey. Meantime, President Trump continues to talk tough, saying that, quote, all options are on the table in dealing with North Korea's nuclear program. And just this morning, Vice President Mike Pence says he has not ruled out a meeting with the North Koreans while he is overseas. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss all of this with two scholars following these developments closely. What are your questions for them? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. That's the opening of the South Korean national anthem, which we'll be hearing when the Winter Olympics kick off on Friday in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Today, we'll look at the current state of relations on the Korean Peninsula. We'll also discuss how real the nuclear threat is, considering harsh rhetoric between the U.S. and North Korea, and what political tensions will be like once the Olympics are over. Joining me in the studio, Rebecca Gibbons, who is a visiting assistant professor of government at Bowdoin College, and Bradley Babson, a distinguished lecturer in the Department of Government and Legal Affairs at Bowdoin. He is also a consultant on Asian affairs. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you think the Olympics will lead to better relations between North and South Korea? Are you worried about the tough talk between the U.S. and North Korea? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you. And I'd like to start with the news of the day. Vice President Pence will be representing the U.S. at the Olympic Games. On his way, he stopped in Alaska, where he spoke with reporters. And this is interesting to me on a lot of levels, but on one of them, news outlets seem to be reporting this story in two different ways. Some are focusing on the fact that the vice president said he will not rule out contact with the North Koreans. His quote, I have not requested a meeting, but we'll see what happens. And seizing on that is really interesting. But then others are focusing on the vice president's commitment to be tough and to try to counteract the narrative that the North Koreans want to tell. And here's a quote. He says, we're traveling to the Olympics to make sure North Korea doesn't use the powerful symbolism and the backdrop of the Winter Olympics to paper over the truth about their regime, a regime that oppresses its own people, a regime that threatens nations around the world, a regime that continues its headlong rush to develop nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. So I want to ask each of you, what do you make, Bradley Babson, of Pence's words in Alaska just earlier today?
Well, I think it covers the two big questions, which is whether it's at all possible for the U.S. and North Korea to find a way, a face-saving way, to begin a process that could lead towards substantive talks. We both have preconditions about what we want to know from the other before we're willing to sit down and talk. On our side, we're wanting to know that they are willing to put nuclear issues on the table, the dismantlement of their program. On their side, they want some signal from us that we're willing to back off some of our threats, and particularly through the military exercises that we do jointly with South Korea. I think on the other front, it's quite clear that the Olympics is going to capture the news cycle around the world for the first couple of days. North Korea clearly is using this to try to promote an image of themselves as both militarily strong with the parade that they will be doing the day before, but also culturally sophisticated and competent in the various ways that they present themselves during the Olympics, and soften their image in the international community and hopefully, from their point of view, undermine the pressure tactics that are being pursued aggressively by the United States. I think Mike Pence, understandably, wants to counteract that image of North Korea being both strong and culturally competent in order to maintain that pressure and the support of the international community for the American policy.
Rebecca, what do you hear when you hear what Pence is saying?
Yeah, I see this as a continuation of the policy that the Trump administration has been employing in terms of walking what is a very fine line, and at times I think a dangerous line, between trying to put ultimate pressure and coercive pressure on the regime at with the hopes that we will at some point be able to negotiate. I say it's dangerous because I think there's a risk that you put too much pressure on the regime and there'll be concern thinking that the U.S. Potentially is planning to go to war, and then that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sure, the president says all options are on the table. I mean, that sounds like option of some sort of strike is on the table.
Yeah, and I think so. And I think we're seeing language that's indicative of wanting to put more pressure. I mean, if you think of the language that Trump used in the State of the Union address to talk about North Korea as a growing and imminent threat, if you look at the language that is used in the recently released Nuclear Posture Review, which is the Trump administration's policy for nuclear weapons going forward, North Korea is described as a growing threat that needs to be addressed. And so it seems as though Pence, in going to the Olympics, wants to make sure that in the minds of Americans and potentially coalition partners going forward, reminding them, this is a rogue regime. This is a regime that does terrible things to its people. Let's not let the Olympics and the spirit of really the magical spirit of the Olympics overshadow what we know about that regime.
Bradley, you mentioned that both sides have preconditions to talking. My understanding is that these preconditions, what each side wants from the other, are things that neither side is willing to budge on.
Well, the question is also a question of timing and process. Would we be willing to enter into talks knowing that denuclearization comes at the end of the process rather than the beginning of the process? And that's where I think we've entered into a different point of view than the North Koreans. From their point of view, they learned a lesson a long time ago that the best defense is a good offense, and that the threat that they consider is real is something that they would like to see reformed in order to feel comfortable that they could make decisions like denuclearizing. They would need a security assurance that was quite convincing before they're going to come to that point.
Rebecca, this is your focus of study right now. I mean, are they ever going to come to this point?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question, right? And a lot of what's out there seems to paint the Kim Jong-il regime as being irrational, right? And so some of what the Trump administration seems to be putting forward is that we can't trust this regime. Once they have nuclear weapons, who knows what they'll do with them? And yet the policy to develop nuclear weapons is really quite a rational response to insecurity, right? And it's been mentioned in many articles and many op-eds that the regime would look around and see what happened to Gaddafi and see what happened to Saddam Hussein and say, those aren't the shoes that I want to be in the future. What can I do to prevent that from happening to me? And that nuclear weapons and deterring a great power from invasion or from regime change is really a rational step. So it seems that what Brad is talking about a security assurance is really going to be a necessary component of any agreement that helps them denuclearize. And I think it's hard to imagine that they would trust the U.S. In my own classes, I talk about the example of Gaddafi in Libya. He gave up his nuclear weapons after negotiations with the U.S. and the British in 2003. And then what happened to him in 2011, right? So from a non-proliferation standpoint, that probably wasn't the best policy to engage in regime change and essentially be there to provide support for those who ended up killing Gaddafi, right? So even if in the moment you're assuring a regime survival, how do you know 10 years, 20 years from now that policy is going to hold true? The nuclear weapons, they're still going to be there. So I think it's a really hard question.
And Brad, I know you agree with Rebecca that Kim is acting rationally.
Yes, I think it's too bad that the impression is that there is an irrational dynamic at work in this young leader, because he's been very systematic and quite strategic in the way he's tried to build up a national strategy of strengthening the country, both by developing its nuclear and missile forces on the security side and at the same time giving equal priority to economic development and trying to strengthen the country from an economic and social point of view.
Rebecca, if there were a nuclear strike, are we, is the U.S., is South Korea, is Japan capable of shooting down a missile carrying a nuclear warhead?
It's a really good question. I would not want to be confident in missile defense as being what's going to save us from this. I mean, when we're talking about a type of defense that can intercept an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile, the tests of those systems, some tests have failed, some tests have succeeded, right? And if there's more than one, it becomes more difficult. And so when we're really talking about that type of missile, we don't have as much confidence in that ballistic missile defense system as we do in kind of shorter range systems. The type of system that the U.S. has put in place in South Korea, for example, has a much stronger record, the so-called THAAD system. So hopefully we never get to that place where we have to test that out in the real world.
Brad, what's the level of concern in South Korea and Japan about North Korea's nuclear program?
Well, it's quite severe in Japan because Japan is clearly under threat by their medium-range missiles, which have been proven to be fairly accurate. They've flown several over Japan in the last year. So I think the Japanese have good reason to be concerned, and particularly given old history in Japan and Korean relations back in the early part of the last century. South Korea has been living under the shadow of artillery shells that could wipe out Seoul within minutes for decades. And so the nuclear threat is not really existentially new for them. And so it is less a direct impact on South Korean thinking than it is on Japanese or American thinking, because they've been living with this type of existential threat for a long time. And those artillery shells are quite capable of wreaking enormous havoc and civilian loss of life without relying on nuclear capability.
We're having a conversation about South and North Korea with two scholars, Bradley Babson and Rebecca Gibbons. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're having this conversation today, of course, instead of another day, because this is the week that the Olympics begin. And the Olympics are in Pyeongchang. And also, for the first time ever, North and South Korea are fielding a unified team, in this case, a women's hockey team. What's the significance of this? Is it symbolic or something much more?
Oh, I think it's both symbolic and potentially could open the doors for some relaxation of tensions between the two Koreas and a recognition of their deeper history of Koreanness and being having common historical culture and values that are become not known just to the Koreans but to the world. That relationship, marching under into the games under a unification flag, and the music not being the national anthem of either country, but an arang song, which is an old Korean folk song that they both share and love, is one way to demonstrate that feeling of being Koreans together. On the other hand, it's true that there's a lot of potential for this dust dissipating after the Olympics and not going very far. That certainly happened in previous Olympics where they and other sports events where they have marched together. There's not necessarily a follow-through that's going to be meaningful. But I must say already there's been one positive agreement between the two Koreas, which was the decision to reopen the military hotline so that they can avoid miscalculations of events that might happen on the border, and reduced the tension somewhat, which I think has already been one small positive outcome of this initiative.
I guess what I would say is that this could be one small first step, and it really is a matter of what comes after that. And I think that reiterates some of what Brad is saying, that this has the potential to be the start. But if, you know, there's a military parade or there's incendiary rhetoric that comes out soon after that accompanies it, it could just be a blip instead of kind of an emerging pattern. Something that we've also seen is that in polling, we see that younger South Koreans, are less enthusiastic about this happening. And so they might not see it in the same positive way that some older Koreans might see it.
Oh, isn't that interesting? What does North Korea want, Brad?
I think North Korea wants a number of things. One is they want recognition that they're a serious country that should be taken seriously, that they have competencies and they have a right to be treated as an equal among other countries. That's one reason why they still participate actively in the United Nations and various agencies and use that platform as a reinforcement of their having a stature with other countries that is recognized. Although, interestingly enough, the South Korean Constitution does not recognize North Korea as a separate country. They also, I think, want to have a relationship with the United States, which is something that is a little counterintuitive, but they've always felt that the United States was a good protector of South Korea in a region where they have a lot of history of conflict with their big powers that neighbor them, both China and Japan, historically. So at one level, and you go back to the agreed framework that was negotiated in the 1990s, we were in a relationship with North Korea for a number of years where we kept talking with each other. There was no great progress on the project of building nuclear reactors while keeping their program under wraps, but it did keep us in relationship and conversation, and that's disappeared. We have not been in any conversation with them for quite a number of years now, and that's something I think they would like to rectify, at least get back into some kind of interaction with us.
Right. I agree with Brad, but I'd like to add that I also am of the opinion that they would like to split the alliance between the U.S. and South Korea, and that they would like to get the U.S. off the peninsula, and that the nuclear program does offer one way of doing that. So if we see that in the future that Americans are so fearful of being attacked with nuclear weapons from North Korea that they're less willing to support this traditional alliance, then you do have the risk of some split in the alliance. And I think because of that, it's really important that U.S. leaders talk to the American public about the importance of this alliance and the history behind it and why we have it.
Do they want the U.S. off the peninsula because they want a unified Korea?
Well,
historically, the answer is yes. And they did not succeed in that during the Korean War, and they've not succeeded since. So I think that's not an aspiration that's very realistic, and I don't think in their hearts they really expect it. What I think they want first is to get a more peaceful environment to pursue their own internal economic development. We talked about young South Koreans. Well, young North Koreans, and I've met young North Koreans, they want to be part of the world and have a future. They're not hung up on the past, and the question is how do they reach out to the rest of the world within the system that contains them in ways that could make them feel that they could be part of things. And they are getting to know a lot more about the outside world in recent years for a variety of reasons. And so I do think the intergenerational dynamic at work in both countries is an important one that will have an impact over time.
Rebecca?
No, I agree.
That's fine. We do need to take a break. And if you'd like to join the conversation, please do so. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can email us talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Hello, I'm Nina Totenberg. Whether you come for the essential news of the day or to be inspired by intriguing new ideas or to become more engaged with the world around you, the reasons you choose to tune into and love Maine Public Radio matter so very much. That's why your contribution today also matters, because this vital service comes with a cost, and no matter what your reason for bringing public radio into your life, your support is the key to Maine Public Radio's continued efforts to keep our community informed, enriched, and in tune with our world. Please call or go to mainepublic.org right now and make a donation that will be counted towards the Super Thursday one-day pledge drive, and thank you.
Super Thursday is this Thursday, February 8th, and you can contribute right now online at mainepublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475, and thank you for your support. And on the morning of Super Thursday, at 7 o'clock, Mark Vogelzang, President and CEO of Maine Public, will be at Eggs and Issues for a talk on why independent journalism matters. The Portland Region Chamber of Commerce's Eggs and Issues series takes place at the Holiday Inn by the Bay. Mark will talk about the state of public radio and television today, the strategic decision to increase deeper in-depth reporting at Maine Public, and the role of NPR and PBS in the era of fake news. If you aren't a Portland Chamber member, you can attend and receive a special Chamber member price for the event. Please visit mainepublic.org and click on events for all the details.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, assessing the situation in North and South Korea. With me in the studio, Brad Babson, who is Distinguished Lecturer in the Department of Government and Legal Affairs at Bowdoin College, and Rebecca Gibbons, also at Bowdoin, where she is a visiting Assistant Professor of Government and teaches a course on nuclear proliferation. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Let's talk about the trading of barbs and name calling. Trump famously calling Kim Rocket Man over and over. Kim referring to President Trump as a lunatic. This level of discourse is really scary to a lot of people around the world. Rebecca, does it scare you?
It does. I mean, I think it's quite unfortunate. First of all, I don't think it's going to get us where we want to be. It's not getting us any closer to potentially negotiating by insulting Kim Jong-il, or for that matter, him insulting President Trump. I think the tweets in particular are unfortunate, that nuclear weapons are just too significant, too grave, too important to be something where we're making policy by tweet, right? There's too much room for misperception when we're talking about tweets. What's really dangerous here is that North Korea has a very nascent, a new nuclear weapons program, right? And so when a country has a new nuclear weapons program, it faces a risk that another country might try to take out that program. And so this has happened before with other countries taking out reactors. And so that's a real risk, and I imagine that's on the minds of the leaders there. And so if Trump issues a tweet or some kind of vague policy that could be misread as a threat, it is possible that the leaders in North Korea could feel some kind of pressure that they need to use their weapons before they are attacked, right? And there's people advocating that any attack on their nuclear system would have to be very secret, and we wouldn't necessarily announce it before. So you can imagine that leadership kind of reading into what's going on, and one piece of information they have are those tweets and those threats. So I do see it as dangerous and something that should be avoided in the future.
Yeah, I just say, if you try to take an optimistic view of this, the tweeting and the name calling does have the impact of raising public awareness and anxiety about the challenges and the realities of the challenges on the Korean Peninsula. And in some sense, it's elevated concern about Korea, both publicly and within our own public policy community, to a level that we haven't really seen before. It's not strategic patience and wait and do nothing, which was the umbrella of the last administration. Now, that could have a positive impact of people expecting significantly different activity and changes and whatever actions occur. It could be very bad, but it also could be good. It could create a reason to do things differently than we have before. And if that's true, it potentially could move us down a road towards negotiation. But as I said before, it's important that we get over the perception that we've painted ourselves into corners. We need a face-saving way to get back into some kind of a conversation. And the hopeful part of the Olympics is it is a way that has allowed people to come together, even briefly, in a way that no one loses face right now in this period. And is that going to create a space where something could happen that's different? We don't know. And even whether it's a conversation between President Moon and the head of the North Korean delegation, Kim Jong-nam, who is the nominal head of state. He's an elderly gentleman who's been involved he's been leading the Supreme People's Assembly for 30 years, and he would be a credible interlocutor for a first conversation with the South Koreans and even potentially with Vice President Pence if the opportunity avails itself during these next few days.
So Brad touched on the fact that this might make the public more aware, and I think that's true. Certainly these tweets are talked about not only in the news, but in late night television. I mean, they're all over the media. But I think my concern is that if we're raising anxiety but not talking to the public about what a potential conflict with North Korea would look like, then we're kind of marching down a road where the public thinks this is the only option forward. We have to go have some kind of actual war with North Korea to take out these capabilities that they have without talking to the public about what a war might look like there, that this is not going to be Iraq and Afghanistan. This is a very different type of war, that we have a military that's stretched thin, that many Americans are going to die in this conflict if it were to happen because of the hundreds of thousands of about 200,000 Americans that live in South Korea. So I do think it's important that there's more public awareness both of this issue and nuclear weapons broadly. But I think we also need more awareness of what a conflict would be, because the more we have this rhetoric that they're an imminent and growing threat, then that seems to me like an argument that's being made for going to war.
Yeah, we talked earlier about the South Koreans not feeling that threatened by the nuclear weapons pointed at them. But the talk about the use of nuclear weapons and other military intervention by the United States has certainly raised the anxiety of the South Korean population that we might do something that could be very bad for them, because we're protecting our own interests rather than South Korean interests. This raises a very fundamental question about the alliance, because since the end of the Korean War, the alliance has all been about protecting South Korea, and now it's all about protecting us, not just South Korea. And that's a very new dynamic at work in the alliance relationship, and I don't think we or the South Koreans have found our way into understanding how to deal with the duality of the meaning of that relationship.
And it's all happening very quickly.
Yes.
We have a post from Kim on Facebook. She's quoting Human Rights Watch from 2017. She writes, North Korea remains one of the most repressive authoritarian states in the world, ruled for 7 decades by the Kim family and the Workers' Party of Korea. During his 5th year in power, Kim Jong-un continued to generate fearful obedience by using public executions, arbitrary detention, and forced labor, tightening travel restrictions to prevent North Koreans from escaping and seeking refuge overseas, and systematically persecuting those with religious contacts inside and outside the country. And the question is, do we want to support this regime? Is a regime like this stable? Should we allow them to, quote, come to the table and ignore the abuse of their people? The magic of the Olympics cannot wipe out these crimes. Do we really think we can reason with this type of government?
Well, let me just say that I think it's a really important aspect of what's going on are the dynamics of change inside North Korea. It's not just a story of repression by the state trying to maintain a social control policy, because the general population in South Korea has changed dramatically in the last 20 years with the bottom-up growth of the market economy.
The population of North Korea,
Korea. And the fact of the matter is most North Koreans now make their livelihoods in the markets, not linked and tied to the state. And the social contract between the state and the people is dramatically different today. And the real challenge for the internal challenge for the regime is the growing sense of independence and being able to make your own way in the markets and pursue individual interests. Making money has become more important than being a good party soldier. So part of the dynamic we're seeing is an internal challenge between an old archaic system and a changing population driven by the growing markets and the role of markets in the society and the freedom that comes with individual choice when people can use markets to pursue their own interests and succeed with their own efforts.
One thing I'd add is that we do see the Trump administration talking about human rights violations. So, for example, having the former North Korean citizen at the State of the Union to emphasize things that the—
And Otto Warbier's father.
And having Otto's father go with Pence to the Olympics. So I do think the administration is highlighting the human rights abuses. And I don't necessarily see negotiation as supporting the regime. I think American leaders ultimately would like to see this regime opened up and, of course, not have these human rights abuses. But the primary issue right now is nuclear weapons. And I think this is somewhat analogous to what we're seeing in terms of an argument over the Iran nuclear deal, where a lot of people are unhappy because the Iranian regime still does many things that we don't like in the international system. And yet that deal was narrowly focused on nuclear weapons because that was the priority. And it wasn't about all these other things that happen.
Interesting analogy. Kim, thank you so much for your comment. Let's talk about this a little more broadly, Rebecca, about what's going on with nuclear weapons all over the world. I have read that and know someone who's talked recently with Mikhail Gorbachev, who is very, very concerned about the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the seeming lack of commitment to disarmament agreements. There's kind of two different schools of thought right now in the world, not just in the U.S. and not just in on the Korean Peninsula, aren't there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There really are two divergent trends we're seeing right now. So on one hand, something that I've been studying is there's this been a global grassroots effort partnering with some certain states that have tried to bring about this treaty banning the possession of nuclear weapons. And they succeeded this summer. So at the UN on July 7th, 122 countries voted on this new treaty that would ban the possession of nuclear weapons. No nuclear weapon states or states that are under a nuclear umbrella, other than the Netherlands, were at those negotiations. So on one hand, we have all the nuclear have-nots saying that these weapons are illegitimate. They are not compliant with humanitarian law. They're really framing their argument in a humanitarian frame. And then on the other side, we have the nuclear weapon states, many of which are improving their nuclear arsenals, both in number and in their quality. We see the U.S. is doing this, right? The U.S. is planning to improve all legs of the nuclear triad, the submarine-based leg, the aircraft leg, and then the internet, the ICBMs, that to a tune of $1.2 trillion. So, and we see Pakistan's improving its arsenal, India's improving its arsenal, Russia is improving its arsenal, China is improving its arsenal. So all the nuclear weapon states, for the most part, are improving at the same time that there's this growing trend to delegitimize these weapons. And I'm not really sure how these two trends are going to come together and kind of figure out the way forward on nuclear weapons.
We're going to go to Steve, who's calling from Peaks Island. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Good show today, and I'm particularly interested. I just returned from 5 years teaching in South Korea. I was there as a Peace Corps volunteer 40 years ago and also 3 years ago visited North Korea. So an observation that I had was that when you visit North Korea, the one unifying principle that you see everywhere is one country, one peninsula. This is, I think, the driving force behind North Korea, and it is totally different in South Korea. South Koreans have no desire to unify with North Korea. So the Olympic strategy that you see now is going to work much more effectively for propaganda on North Korea's part. And I'd love to hear reactions from your two guests.
Well, I definitely agree that the propaganda value is likely to be more beneficial to North Korea than to South Korea. I think South Korea's main interest is to keep the Olympics safe from any kind of disturbance, and it is gaining any, if you like, incrementally popularity in the international sphere. And they're very well engaged in the rest of the world in popular ways anyway. So I would agree with that basic conclusion. I don't think that the North Korean people, though, have the same outlook about their future as the government may want them to believe in its own internal propaganda. Most of the North Koreans that I've talked to, and I've been to North Korea three times and I've met with them in a number of places, they have a more realistic expectation. And what they want is just a life, and one that allows them a certain amount of freedom and a way to pursue their own interests. They have a lot more interaction with China and across the border in various ways than they do with South Korea. And I'd say many North Koreans are more looking toward the North and the South in terms of a longer-term connectivity that makes them feel able to pursue their own goals.
Steve, I'm curious, how were you able to visit North Korea?
Americans were allowed to visit North Korea until really recently, September. So if you were an American and you wanted to go to visit North Korea, North Korea made it pretty easy. You just go to China, you hook up with an agency, travel agency, and you fly out of Beijing. It's no problem. It was no problem until September.
Interesting. Well, Steve, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your perspective. We are going to go to another quick break, but before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to talk a little more about the Olympics, but this time we're going to talk about what's happening in the world of sports. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunderfation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public.
On the next Intelligence Squared US, is deregulation good for business? Is the stock market too high?
So I'm of the view, and I don't know if Donald Trump agrees with this, but the growth solves all the problems.
We have never, ever had a deficit anything like this as a share of the economy.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues.
That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, reminding you that Maine Public Radio is the kind of radio that makes a difference every day. You get news and information from Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You get insights on Radiolab. Get a little banter from that Peter Sagal guy on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You get unexpected lessons from This American Life. And, of course, the local focus of Maine Things Considered. Every time you listen, you know that quality programs are going to take you on journeys. This is Steve Inskeep asking you to contribute to Maine Public Radio to make sure that radio you value and count on continues to enrich this community with its rewards. Call or go to mainepublic.org today, and your donation counts toward the upcoming Super Thursday one-day pledge drive. Thanks.
Super Thursday is in 2 days. That's February 8th, and you can call 1-800-866-1475. Thank you so much.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, North Korea, South Korea, and what to make of their relations with the rest of the world. Joining me today, Rebecca Gibbons, who's visiting assistant professor of government at Bowdoin, and Bradley Babson, who is a distinguished lecturer in the Department of Government and Legal Affairs at Bowdoin. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Brad, before the break, Steve talked about his visit to North Korea, spending 5 years teaching in South Korea. You've also traveled to North Korea multiple times. Was it difficult for you to get there? And what kind of access did you have to regular people?
Well, the first trip I went when I was working with the World Bank, and it was in 1998 in February when the famine had hit the front pages of the world, and the impact of the famine on the society and the economy and the implications for destabilizing the security situation in the peninsula became a major concern. And so part of North Korea's response during that period was to open up to the rest of the world. And they normalized relations with almost all of Europe and Canada and Australia. And they were exploring the possibility of joining the IMF and the World Bank. And I was invited by the government to go and to explain to them what joining the World Bank would mean for them. And my observation from that first trip was that the ignorance of economics was just as much as an obstacle as ideology to their ability to think rationally about how to manage their way out of a very difficult economic and social humanitarian situation, and that to help that country get back into a more positive environment for its own people, it was important not just to focus on humanitarian food aid and health aid, and there was a lot of American support in humanitarian assistance during that period, but also to begin to engage them in knowledge so that they could make better policy choices about for their own benefit and how they related to the rest of the world. So that was the orientation of my first trip. But it was a pretty weird country, and I was I realized that its isolation was really extraordinary. And at the same time, that's when South Korea was in the midst of the financial crisis, and Kim Dae-jung had just been elected president, and he was trying to cope with the crisis in the South at the same time, pursue his sunshine policy of finding a way to open up a relationship with the North, and he was quite successful with that during his presidential term. I went back several other times later, all focused on economic-related things. But I must say, the last time I was in North Korea in 2013, the ceiling had lifted a lot. And I was, just one little story, I was talking with an economics professor at Kim Il-sung University who had studied in Canada. And he told me that he was on the internet every day studying the World Bank website, trying to learn about the knowledge economy and how it could apply to their situation. So it was a very different environment, a more open environment for talking about things, and clearly much more aware of the outside world than the first time that I went there.
Interesting. We have an email from Licia. Why does the U.S. get to dictate who can have nuclear weapons when I believe it has the most of any nation in the world? This administration's rhetoric is bullish and has no diplomatic integrity. It should be doing everything in its power to de-escalate tensions and not increase the heat by using threats. Mm-hmm. Rebecca.
Yeah, so I think the caller's first point about why the U.S. gets to dictate who gets nuclear weapons and who doesn't does reflect some of the frustration that we've seen in the world that resulted in this treaty that we had this summer. Why are there nuclear haves and have-nots in the international system? And I think some people think, well, if the U.S. thinks deterrence is so valuable, if nuclear deterrence is so valuable for its security, why wouldn't it be valuable for other security, right? And so the hypocrisy of that, I think, makes a number of people upset. In terms of the U.S. dictating policy, I mean, there is a treaty. There is the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons that entered into force in 1970. And all of the countries that have signed that treaty have agreed to its provisions, which include the fact that there are five official nuclear weapons states. So that's the U.S., Russia, China, Great Britain, and France. And so per this treaty, those countries are allowed to have nuclear weapons, are considered legitimate nuclear weapons states. But of course, that treaty also requires all states in the treaty to pursue eventual nuclear disarmament. And I think that's why we have so much tension today between nuclear haves and have-nots, because once the Cold War ended, there was a sense that maybe these five nuclear weapon states would move more quickly towards getting rid of their nuclear weapons. And they have. And so if you listen to a U.S. diplomat today, they will say the U.S. has gotten rid of 85% of its nuclear weapons since Cold War highs. And I think for some people, that's just not quick enough. I should also point out that yesterday was the date when both Russia and the United States had to come to the numbers required by the New START treaty. So as of yesterday, both countries legally had as deployed warheads. They had 1,550 deployed warheads on 700 deployed delivery vehicles. And so even though we're having tensions with Russia, even though there's problems in many realms, they did both come and abide by those treaty commitments set out in the New START treaty. So that's a little bit of good news, I think, in the world of arms control.
Interesting. We'll go to Peyton calling from Brunswick. Hi, Peyton. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering about all this concern about North Korea sending a missile to the United States. But, I mean, it seems very alarmist to me. I can't imagine a scenario where they would be that stupid. I mean, it would be suicide if they sent a missile to the United States. Their country would be annihilated. So I'm just wondering what your panel thinks about that.
Thanks, Peyton. Brett?
Well, I think that Kim Jong-un's strategy is to, and he declared this in his New Year's speech, was that we now have achieved our strategic objective of being able to hit the United States and therefore have a deterrence against an attack by the United States on us. And I think what their hope is that we would accept that. I'm not sure we do, but at this stage, because there's still questions about their actual capabilities in aspects of that claim. But I think that their intention is to use the credible threat of a nuclear attack on the U.S. as a way of obtaining the same kind of deterrence that Russia and China have with us in their nuclear forces.
Yeah, I would agree. So in the nuclear posture review from the Trump administration that just came out on Friday, it makes clear that any North Korean attack will result in the end of that regime. That's a quote from the nuclear posture review. So that is the U.S. policy. I think in general, North Korea wants these weapons to deter the U.S. What I'm worried about is that you have a crisis or you have a miscalculation like the type we've talked about, and you do end up in some kind of scenario where there's pressure to use nuclear weapons.
All right, Peyton, thank you. And oh, go ahead, Brad.
Yeah, just one other thing. I think China's posture on the idea of an exchange of nuclear attacks between the two Korea and us is also a factor, because China does have a security treaty with North Korea. And as I understand it, their position is they've told the North Koreans, if the U.S. attacks you, we're in, we'll support you. If you attack them, you're on your own.
And thank you, Peyton, for that call. I think we've kind of touched on this, but not really talked about it. What is what happened in Hawaii last month teach us about our readiness for some sort of nuclear incident, and how Americans feel about the likelihood of this?
Mm-hmm. I do think that, as we've talked about, maybe the South Koreans aren't as fearful, but in America, we have seen real fears. I mean, just anecdotally in conversations, I've talked to people who don't normally think about nuclear weapons who are concerned. And probably in 2017, I had the most questions ever of how worried do I have to be about nuclear weapons, just from friends and family. So I think Americans are concerned. And what we saw with the unfortunate alert that happened in Hawaii is that many people didn't know what to do, didn't know what the safest thing to do would be, you know, to get into a shelter, to be away from windows, and to have things like supplies that you would have for a long time in case you did have to shelter in place and you didn't go out into an environment that had radiation in it. So although that was such an unfortunate event and can't imagine the panic of those people in those 38 minutes, I do think the best we can take from that is that we all need to be better educated about what we would do in those scenarios and have plans.
We'll go to Constantino, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Constantino. Go ahead. Constantino, are you there?
I'm right here.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, very interesting conversation today. What we haven't really touched upon is Trump himself, who seems to be the biggest problem of any diplomatic strategy whatsoever. I mean, he's gone as far as to say on, I believe it's Chris Matthews' Hardball, that he aired the question, why do we have nuclear weapons? And if we have them, why don't we use them? How is that going to apply to any diplomatic strategy going forward?
Yeah, and I thank you for that call. I think that there are many Americans that are concerned, including Americans in Congress. So both in the House and the Senate, there are bills being put forward that suggest that they would like to rescind the president's ability to do a nuclear first strike on another country because they have some of the same concerns. There are some people that have liked to attribute this idea called madman theory to Trump. And this is something that comes from the Nixon administration. The idea that you would put it out there that, you know, this guy might be so crazy that he might actually use nuclear weapons and that that would have a positive effect of being a deterrent. But I think that theory has largely been discredited and something that we don't necessarily want to attempt.
Yeah, I would only say that all you could hope is that it creates enough of a smokescreen that maybe something below the radar in terms of informal conversation could occur without anybody noticing, because all the attention is on another place.
I want to close by asking each of you, if you were in South Korea right now advising Vice President Pence, or you were able to have President Trump's ear, what would you advise to each of them about this really tricky time in geopolitics on the Korean Peninsula? Go ahead, Rebecca.
I think I would try to talk to Trump and perhaps Pence about crises and how quickly they can escalate and some historical examples that we have. And so that we need to be very careful about the kind of rhetoric that we're using, that we're not encouraging Kim Jong-un to think about using nuclear weapons, and that we ultimately, our interests are best served by getting to the diplomatic table.
Would you recommend the same strategy that the Obama administration had? Was it called
strategic patience?
Strategic patience.
I do think it's important that we are putting some coercive pressure on the regime and that we continue with these sanctions. I think we are seeing evidence that they're having some effect, in hopes that we will be able to find some incentive to help de-escalate the situation.
Yeah, in a situation like this, the alternative to governments talking to each other is what's called track two diplomacy, where you have very senior, experienced people meeting informally together, not as officials, but to use a different context for exchanging perspectives on what's going on in the minds of each side in their capitals. The risk of miscalculation is very high if you don't have direct contact with one another. So the second best solution to an official level conversation is track two. And the North Koreans have been willing and active in track two conversations. question is how well those are supported by the Trump administration as a way to get a better understanding of what's actually the thinking within North Korea is at the senior level.
So who's taking part in these track two negotiations right now? Are these business leaders, NGOs?
Many of them are former government officials who've worked on North Korea and are known to the North Koreans personally and have some level of trust with them. Some are academics. I've participated in some just because they wanted somebody to talk about economics, not just politics. So it's often people who have some experience interacting with North Korea, have a certain track record of trust that helps create an environment where a certain amount of honesty in the exchange can take place.
And what about the joint military exercises that have been postponed for the Olympics but are still scheduled with South Korea and the U.S.? Would you go on with those if you were running the show?
Well, North Korea is looking to see whether we're going to make any adjustment in the way we handle those. I don't think it's their expectation they're going to be canceled, although that's what they're saying publicly. But the question is whether we dial back the dial a little bit in order to send a signal that we're willing to create some space in order to find a way forward in some kind of conversation in some format that both sides feel they could work with to start with.
Well, thank you both for being here today. Bradley Babson, a distinguished lecturer in the Department of Government and Legal Affairs at Bowdoin College and a consultant on Asian affairs, and Rebecca Gibbons, visiting assistant professor of government, also at Bowdoin. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. You can find past editions of this program at maincalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn, and tomorrow on the program, the latest from the world of sports. As we leave, we're going to close with a listen to the Korean folk song Ali Long that Brad mentioned. This will be the joint anthem of North and South Korea. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.